Well, we've been studying in the book of Jeremiah this fall, and Jeremiah is notoriously difficult book of the Bible to read because it skips back and forth chronologically over and over, all over the place, while at the same time it's telling a very important, super important part of Israel's history. The story of Israel's exile into Babylon. Now, we tend to think of the exile as a single event in history, but it actually took place over about 15 years or so, depending on what you count as the beginning. And over that period of time, there were at least three exiling events that sent maybe between 6 and 40,000 people. The Bible has contrasting reports about how many people exactly were sent away, but probably several thousand people out of Judah and into Babylonian captivity. The timeline of the exile is also not easy to follow or understand because of what happens to Jerusalem's kings. There are several kings through this place, and some of the kings are killed, some of them are deported, some of them are replaced by the Babylonian authorities while all this is going on. And keeping track of the kings of Jerusalem during this period of time is like trying to keep your eye on the ball end of the cup in one of those shell games. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know, you're moving everything around and you're going, who's the king now? Where's the king? Where's the king? Keeping track is literally that hard as you read the book of Jeremiah. The geopolitical situation also involved several regional players, not just Babylon. So there's a lot going on here. And it's fun to study if you're a nerd like me. But I know most people would say they'd rather just get to the bottom line than learn all of the details of what happened during this period of Israel's history. Our story today is from Jeremiah's 32nd chapter. That's 32 out of 52 chapters. It's the longest book in the Bible besides the Psalms. And it relates, you know what, that's not true. I don't even know why I said it. 52, there's 66 in Isaiah. Try to think about maybe Genesis has 50, right? All right, so it's 52 chapters anyway, and today's text is from the 32nd chapter, but it relates what happened to Jerusalem near the end of Jerusalem's existence. Probably what happened in this text is sometime in the year of 588 BC, or BCE if you prefer. That's almost 6 centuries before the time of Jesus. So this is a long, long time ago. Think about that. It's in the last few months before the final fall of Jerusalem. And the king of Jerusalem at this point is King Zedekiah. And he decided to stop paying tribute to Babylon, who was in control of that region at that time. He decided to stop paying tribute to Babylon, which you might imagine attracted a lot of negative attention from King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, who sent his army marching back to Jerusalem, where they laid siege against it. The siege went on for more than 2 years, and as you can imagine, the situation in Jerusalem became quite dire. They started running out of food. They wondered if they were going to be able to survive. And meanwhile, there's the prophet Jeremiah. Zedekiah, King Zedekiah, had him confined in what the text says are prison quarters in the king's palace. Now, King Zedekiah was unhappy with Jeremiah, who had by now earned himself quite a reputation among Jerusalem's power brokers. So Jeremiah was confined and shut down from preaching, but he apparently still had access to conversations with King Zedekiah at some level or another. And it's in this sorry state of the nation that God spoke to Jeremiah and in a vision and told him to buy some land. And soon after the vision was over, Jeremiah's cousin, Hanamel, actually showed up and wanted to sell Jeremiah a field in their hometown of Anathoth. That's hard to say. Anathoth, A-N-A-T-H-O-T-H is how we transliterate it. But it was a little town, probably just outside of Jerusalem, probably not more than 2 miles away. Now think about this. Jeremiah's in prison. The Babylonians are about to knock down the city walls. It's possible that the Babylonian armies are even camped out on the very land that Jeremiah's cousin wanted to sell. So this land had no value. It was likely very soon to belong to the Babylonians, if it didn't already, and they could distribute the property however they wanted to. So who would buy this land that Jeremiah's cousin wanted to sell? Who would buy it? His cousin trying to sell that land is like me saying, hey, I've got some acreage in the Syrian desert where Syria and Iraq and ISIS are fighting, and I'd like to sell it to you. Who would buy that land? Who would buy this land in Anathoth? Well, Jeremiah bought it. And he bought it demonstratively. He called witnesses. He signed the deeds to a land in a very public ceremony. This is the original deed of trust right here. He signed the deed in a very public ceremony. He paid his cousin the money and had the deed stored in a highly secured place so it could be preserved and could be retrieved in the future. Buying this land was a bold and concrete act of hope in Israel's future. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. But it was a bold and concrete act of hope in Israel's future. But even Jeremiah must have felt foolish buying that land. Because when the transaction was over, he turned to the Lord in prayer and he said, why, Lord, why would you tell me to buy this land? And the Lord answered Jeremiah in verse 36 of chapter 32 of Jeremiah. And that's where I'm going to start reading this morning. Here's what the Lord said to Jeremiah. You have been saying, this city will be handed over to the king of Babylon through sword, famine, and disease. But this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I will gather them from all the countries where I've scattered them in my fierce anger and rage. I will bring them back to this place to live securely. They will be my people, and I will be their God. I will give them one heart and one mind so that they may worship me all the days of their lives for their own good and for the good of their children after them. I will make an everlasting covenant with them, never to stop treating them graciously. I will pour into their hearts a sense of awe for me so that they won't turn away from me. I will rejoice in treating them graciously, and I will plant them in this land faithfully and with all my heart and being. The Lord proclaims, just as I brought this great disaster on this people, so I will bring on them all the good I promised them. Fields will be bought in this land, a land you have said is bleak and uninhabited, and in the possession of the Babylonians. Fields will be bought, and deeds will be signed, sealed, and witnessed in the land of Benjamin and in the outlying areas of Jerusalem, in the towns of Judah and the highlands, in the towns of the western foothills and the arid southern plain, for I will bring them back from their captivity, declares the Lord. What a promise. The Lord, who had been telling Jeremiah to preach doom and gloom all these years, now instructed Jeremiah to preach and to perform a public act of hope. And Jeremiah did it. And I want to notice two things this morning about Jeremiah's hope that was demonstrated by his purchase of that field in Anathoth. First, I want to note that Jeremiah's hope was displayed in a concrete act, purchasing a field. Hope was displayed in a concrete act. Secondly, I want to notice that Jeremiah's hope looked impractical, very impractical. Now, I know that a lot of our messages over the last 7 months have been about hope, but I'm going to speak about hope again this morning, in part because I think Jeremiah's hope is so absolutely remarkable, but also in part because I think we need to speak about hope and with hope, and we need to put hope into practice. So, I want this message to inspire you to hope in concrete ways, even when that hope might seem impractical. All right. Biblically speaking, hope and faith are very closely related. And the hope that Jeremiah expressed by buying that field could probably be called faith as easily as hope. But today I'm going to stick with the word hope because ultimately what Jeremiah expressed by purchasing that field was a hope in something that could not be seen, was not yet visible, and was probably unimaginable to most people, if not to Jeremiah himself. And his expression of hope was a concrete act. He bought a field. He purchased property. I often hear people use the word hope when what they're really doing is wishing for something. I hope I win the lottery, for instance, someone once said. Or, I hope the weather will get cold soon. But Eugene Peterson once wrote, what we call hoping is often only wishing. We want things we think are impossible, but we have better sense than to spend any money or commit our lives to them. We may wish to win the lottery big, but most of us don't put thousands of dollars down on one number. We wish it would get cooler outside, but few of us go out and purchase a closet full of winter clothes because we know that even when it gets cool, it's going to warm up soon enough. Biblical hope, though, is more than just wishful thinking. It is a concrete act, like buying a field in Anathoth. Jeremiah could have preached. He could have just preached that God would restore Israel from the horrible experience of destruction and exile. Jeremiah could have just announced what God was going to do, that he was going to do good for the people at some point in the future. Jeremiah could have said, my thoughts and prayers are with you all, and I'm hoping for your best. That's something that I say often. But Jeremiah's hope was more than words, more than a vision. It was a concrete act. In fact, it was one of the most concrete acts we can imagine because it was an economic act. An economic transaction that said, I'm putting my money where my mouth is. What he did signaled a concretely economic hope in Israel's restoration. It was saying, you're not just going to be able to move back to this area, but the economy there is going to thrive and flourish. Land is going to be valuable. And I'm so confident in this that I'm making an investment in the land right now. That's biblical hope, a concrete act. Right now, we need some hope. We hope that relationships which have been broken because of political division can be healed. We hope that for an economic recovery that will get people to work and out of poverty. We hope for racial reconciliation in our communities and our nation. But I wonder if our hope needs to be more than just wishful thinking and instead expressed concretely. What if I didn't just hope that my friendships with people who voted differently than I did could be repaired, but actually did everything in my power to stay connected to them, to listen well and speak gently with them, to offer them the benefit of the doubt and lots of grace. What if I didn't just hope for economic recovery that lifted people out of poverty, but I actually invested my time and money in ways that created jobs for people who were poor, or gave my money to nonprofits that were helping people get out of poverty? What if I didn't just hope for racial reconciliation, but actually made friends with people of color or joined an organization that promotes racial reconciliation? Jeremiah's hope was that kind of act, a concrete act, an economic act. It made God's word visible and gave it a place to bloom and grow. And anyone who wanted to could grab a hold of that hope and let it blossom within them. Words of hope can be helpful, but biblical hope is expressed through concrete acts. So let's hope boldly. Let's hope courageously. Let's hope daringly. Let's be people who hope biblically. First thing, right? Second thing is this. I want to note that Jeremiah's hope seemed impractical. In fact, it probably seemed foolish. There was every reason in the world not to buy that land in Anathoth. The Babylonian army had surrounded Jerusalem. It was about to break through the city gates and control the city. They probably already controlled the land around Jerusalem, including Anathoth. Hanamel, Jeremiah's cousin, may have had a deed of property to offer Jeremiah, but that deed might as well have been to the Taj Mahal. The Babylonians now owned that land in Anathoth and could do whatever they wanted to with it. And Jeremiah himself was in prison, or at least some type of confinement, and it's likely he would never even see this land he was purchasing. Even Jeremiah wondered why God would tell him to buy a field, but he still bought it. And he bought it because doing so was an act of obedience. It was impractical, maybe foolish, but he believed disobeying God was far more foolish. And he trusted that God knew more than he knew, saw more than he saw, and understood the future beyond what Jeremiah could even imagine. There are lots of things that Christians are instructed to do that seem impractical and foolish. Forgive someone 70 times 7? Won't people take advantage of you if you just keep forgiving them? Turn the other cheek when someone strikes you? Won't people abuse you and harm you if you do that? Stop worrying about what you'll wear or eat or drink or tomorrow? Wouldn't you do better if you did worry about those things and took responsibility to provide for yourself? Or how about this one? Love your enemies and pray for those who harass you. Who does that? But being a Christian involves obeying God when it may seem impractical, and following Jesus even when it may seem foolish. Everyone may tell us that forgiving others is impractical and that refusing to do violence is foolish, but if Jesus says forgive and don't strike others back, Christians choose the Jesus way because our trust is ultimately that God knows more than we know, sees more than we see, and understands the future beyond what we could ever imagine. Do you think the people of Jerusalem could imagine a restored city and a flourishing economic recovery? Jerusalem at this time had not even been destroyed yet. How could they have imagined a recovery from something that had yet to even happen? But Jeremiah obeyed when there was no reason to obey. He hoped when hope seemed impractical and foolish. And God invites us to obey, and Jesus beckons us to follow, even when we cannot see or understand or imagine why. And people of hope obey and follow because they trust that God knows more than they know, sees more than they see, and understands more than anyone could ever imagine. It might not be easy to discern when God is calling us to hope in a concrete ways that seem impractical. And very few of us have had the kinds of direct visions or revelations that Jeremiah reports. Discernment is difficult, and that's a sermon for another time. But when we have a sense of what God is asking us to do, or when we know what it looks like to follow Jesus in a specific situation, Christians do it even when it may seem silly or impractical, because we are people of hope and we know that nothing is too difficult for God. Again, Eugene Peterson writes, "Hope acts on the conviction that God will complete the work that God has begun, even when the appearances, especially when the appearances, oppose it." Hope is a concrete act that sometimes looks impractical to us. But God knows, sees, and God understands more than we do. So let's place our hope, like Jeremiah did, in the Lord. We're going to sing together again. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus and his righteousness. Will you stand and join us in this song, please?